C1F. Number 2A.
I will take the epitomes which I have given you and just go through those tones and subtones. The whole chapter seems to be at the present stage to show the scientific unity which exists between God and man must be wrought out in life practice. In other words, the divine is manifested as the human. The divine is wrought out as the human. So that the divine and the human are not two things, two entities, two realities, but the divine and the human are only two aspects of one and the same thing, namely the scientific unity which exists between God and man. This would free us from that belief where we say, yes, that's wonderful in the divine, but how it is in the human? In the human it is different. Nothing of that sort. Let's get rid of that distinction which we make between the divine and the human. The Christ, as you know, is defined as the coincidence or spiritual agreement between God and man. That's the definition of Mrs. Eddy. The spiritual agreement between God and man. So there is no duality. One side God, on the other side man. But God and man is one and are two names for the one and the same thing. The divine I or ego. And it only depends from which point of view we look at it, then we have the divine or we have the human. She says in the Apocalypse that John saw the human and divine coincidence. It's a coincidence. It's a complete congruency of, congruency of the divine and the human. She says, John saw the human and the divine coincidence shown in the man Jesus as divinity embracing humanity in life and its demonstration. Again, she says, how that unity must be wrought out in life practice. That it, here it shows that the divine is embracing humanity in life and its demonstration, reducing to human perception and understanding the life which is God. So here she shows very clearly that the human is the divine reduced to human understanding. So the human is not the mortal. We should make that difference between the human and the mortal and see that the human is the divine conceived and perceived through human understanding. But it is the divine. So that the human is really the divine in spite of matter, or in spite of the mortal, we could perhaps say. Well, if we see that, then we take down the barriers between God and man, between a divine standpoint and a human standpoint, and begin to realize, really, that the divinity embraces humanity, That is, as I tried to epitomize here in the first part, namely the humanity of divinity. The second part later on will show the divinity of humanity, just the other way around. So that the whole chapter, which has two parts, the whole chapter just shows the coincidence of the divine and the human. And that divine and the human can be seen in the first part as the humanity of divinity, showing that the divine has a very, very human aspect or trait or characteristic. And the second part shows the divinity of humanity, showing that the real human is divine, that the real human, that remnant of which the prophets were talking, that remnant has in itself everything necessary to bring to completion and fulfillment everything which is in of the divine nature. See that this chapter introduces us to the concept that now are we the sons of God. That we are not going to become the sons of God, but that now we are the sons of God. If God, or the divine principle of being, is all in all, where on earth should there be a place where this one God is not? And if there is no place where it is not, well, then we are the sons of God. Nothing can unmake that. Nothing on earth. And so, all that is necessary, really, is to awake to that fact. It is not to make that fact factual, but it is to awake to that fact which is. And that is bringing it out in life practice. This first part, which is now showing us the humanity of divinity, will show us through the seven synonymous terms how an understanding of the divine synonymous terms for God, how that understanding is the most human thing we can think of, that it has its impact on the human. In other words, what she is going to show here is that we cannot study God, that we cannot understand God without experiencing God in our very lives. We can't. That duality which says, all right, first you have to understand God and then you can apply it and use it in your life practice, is duality. It's old religion. It's blindness from our part, which says there is God somewhere and I'm not there. I'm somewhere else. There is a place besides God. God is not all. And I have to see that I get into the realm of God. That's the belief. Here, she gives us that sense which says, look here, where is God in your understanding? Your consciousness. God is nowhere else than consciousness. So that understanding mind, we have the mind life practice. Understanding spirit, we have the spirit life practice. It must be wrought out in life practice, he says. It must be. It can't help but be brought out. So it's only a matter of consciousness that we begin to accept that an understanding of mind is really being mind. That an understanding of spirit is really being spirit. It can't be something else. We can't be one with the one mind and not have the one mind. But if we have the one mind, we have the whole life practice of the one mind, namely the whole manifestation of the one mind. That's the big point in that whole chapter. Now, you could say with some reason, you could say, well, that's it. So stop and go. Now let's go home. We know now. Yes? We would have it in a nutshell. But the thing is that I'm going on. And I'm going on because we know so well that we have to break down an old belief within ourselves. That old belief which says, I am outside of God, there is a way to get inside of God, and when I am inside of God, I have somehow to take that God outside again and apply it to the outside. Well, that is in a pictorial way showing what we mostly feel. Anyway, that's how I felt. And this chapter is in all ways and means, from all angles, always showing the same grand truth, which says, you know, if you understand the divine mind, the synonymous term, and mind stands for God, and God stands for all in all, and that all in all brings out its own life practice. Therefore you see that if you have an understanding of mind, you are mind-like. And you can't help anymore that this one mind uses you. You can't help it anymore. It must be wrought out in life practice. The moment we touch in consciousness, the one mind, the one spirit, the one soul, principle, the one life, and the one truth, and the one love, we can't help it anymore that they are going to boss us. They are going to tell us what we are, and what we do, and how things are moving. It takes over. Synonym takes over. We are no more going to think something about the synonym and do something with the synonymous terms. Being is independent on human thinking, independent on human willing and wishing and wanting. God is a majestic power, the only authority. And that God has an infinite idea, the Christ idea, and is working out that Christ idea in every detail of our life. And we experience that Christ idea in our life in two ways, as harmony, if we are willing to give in, and as disharmony if we resist it. But always the divine idea we are experiencing. Always. No matter if we humanly, mortally feel it as harmony or as disharmony. No matter. It's always the divine idea. And that divine idea is universal, and is right now going on in the whole universe. And no nation, and no people, and no situation is excluded from it. Not one. That's Christian Science. The science of the Christ idea. So the first subject here is showing us the footsteps which leads us to that understanding of the one mind. And I go through the epitomes with you, and the first epitome of mind says, through an understanding of the science of mind, man has only that mind which is God. See, that's my epitome. But I feel that more or less I have touched with that epitome what it's going to show. Namely, that in the measure as we understand the science of mind, that man has only that mind which is God. That we can't study mind and have another mind than the divine mind. Because the human mind never understands the divine mind. So understanding the divine mind is only possible through the one divine mind, and then we have the divine mind. And if we have the divine mind, that divine mind is wrought out in life practice. Just as a human mind, a mortal mind, is wrought out on the body. As sickness, as irritation, as inflammation, and so on and so on and so on. And the subtones are just showing us the footsteps or the way. First, she shows the study of the science of mind, the perception and acceptance of truth, leads to man's dominion over all the earth. So you can see how she begins to show us how we have that one mind, and says, all right, first you have to study it. You can't help but investigating the science of mind, and so she speaks here about a study of the science of mind, about perceiving and accepting the truth, and that only through this study we begin to see the light of spiritual understanding. That outside of this science, all is mutable. All is variable. Whereas in science, she makes a very definite statement here, man neither sins, suffers, nor dies. See, she doesn't say that in science, man is healed. Actually, she will show that also. But here she shows, you see, that if we study that one mind, that with that one mind, man can no more sin, become sick, or die. Because in the divine mind, such a thing is impossible. So we feel at once the great importance of this chapter. Namely, the great importance which shows that through a right approach to the divine mind, that divine mind brings us into absolute Christian science. Absolute Christian science, as we have seen, is no more that which has to heal the body, but which shows that there is nothing to be healed. It shows us that man must not be healed, but that he cannot become sick. That's the point. So, the first tone is really an introduction and shows, that's why we had to study first what is mind, what are the ideas of mind, in order to know what mind is. So, does that make it clear, so that I'm not misunderstood, that the study of God is necessary, that the study of the divine synonymous terms is necessary, because they give us a sense what those synonymous terms are. But the study of them is only a preliminary step, a preliminary condition, so to say, so as to have that mind which is God. She comes to the next subtone of spirit, where she, I have epitomized understanding instead of belief, unfolds the omnipotence of spirit, and brings to light man's likeness to God. You know spirit as understanding. Understanding is the line of demarcation. Understanding is therefore that which says, all right, if in minus mind I have first to study what mind is, to investigate what mind is, to perceive what mind is, then in the second as spirit, I have to make that distinction between mind and what is not mind, between what are ideas of mind and what are illusions of mortal mind. I have to make that firmament of understanding. And if I make that firmament and rely on that, that brings out man's likeness to God. So, can you feel what Mrs. Eddy, or what the Divine Spirit dictated to Mrs. Eddy, showed as the divine order? Namely, it says to us, as students, says, look here. First, you must study what mind is. Without that, your concept of mind is just a belief. Just a blind belief. See, we have to be careful not to become blind absolutists, where we just say all that there is going on is mind and mind's idea and not understand what mind and mind's idea are. So, the subtones show us the way of investigation, the nature of a synonymous term. And the first thing is to study them. Then the second is to rely on them, to know what they are, to make a reality of them, to build on them, or else everything would be just a blind belief. And only as we really build on our understanding, on what we know, what mind is. Only in that measure, she shows, we gain man's likeness to God. Only in that way. And then she comes to soul, and in soul, she makes the range wider. I have written here, the belief that the divine mind is imprisoned in a sensuous body and escapes from it when the body dies, is a mere imagination. That's the usual belief of mankind, that the mind or soul is in the body, and that when we die, that mind or soul just escapes the body and lives on somewhere else. Whereas God is at once the center and circumference of being. See, here, she goes a step further. Afterwards, I will recapitulate the whole tone. Here she goes a step further and shows that mind cannot be imprisoned in a body. So that we are not looking into the body to find mind. But naturally, we should not look outside of the body to find mind. Because both to look inside and to look outside is localizing being. And therefore she says, soul or mind is neither in the body nor outside the body. It is at once the center and circumference of being. You know that in theology they try to make great strides in their better understanding God, and they feel they have done something wonderful and achieved something very mighty, that instead of saying that God is up there, they now say, well, God is the depth of your being. It's in you, and it's right where you are. Well, if it's outside or inside, it's both a locality. Then it doesn't gain very much by it. 2 and 2 equal 4 is not outside the body nor inside the body. It's not outside the brain nor inside the brain. It's a fact in being. And every localization, either as outside or inside, in our is a wrong concept. And you will agree with me that if we have a quiet moment and listen and find that mind is just mind, and that we don't try to figure out where mind is, up or down, inside, outside, but just mind, center and circumference, that frees us. And not only frees us, it makes us enormously big. Because it takes away the sense of having a mind of our own. And that's what she says right in the next one, in principle, where I've epitomized it and says, in science, there is only one ego. Only one mind. Man can have no other mind of his own, can have no mind of his own, distinct from the all mind. See, the moment she touches principle, she can see there is only one principle, and this one principle as is mind. So, at once, thought is at that point where it has no limits, because soul has no limits, and begins to realize there is only one mind, one ego, one I. Sorry, it's the only I there is. That's the chapter. The chapter, Footsteps of Truth, is that chapter which deals mostly, more than any other chapter, with the concept of the I or ego. Because it wants to bring human thought to the point that it accepts that it is not human but divine. That human mind is not the mind, but that the only mind that we can have is the divine mind. And that there is only one ego, one I. This says, when will the ages understand the ego and realize only one God, one mind or intelligence? A great question. Well, I think the time is coming. The time is coming where the world is beginning to realize that there is only one mind, one principle, one I, one ego.